And welcome. It's great to have you all here. Hopefully you can hear me. I'm just going to waffle for a moment while Rob clicks. Is it going? Brilliantly. So hopefully it's been recorded. And we're going to make sure that they're hopefully up on the website and actually listenable, as we've had some feedback that that's not quite right for everyone, but that's for another time. Before we get going, one request really, over the coming weeks, if you'd be willing to help with refreshments. It's just tea, coffee, that sort of thing. Nothing exotic, unless you want to make it that way. From about 8:15 till 8:30, obviously we have that gap. And so if that's something that you'd be willing to get involved in, if you could speak to Brenda, that'd be really helpful. Obviously it's just coming, setting bits up and putting it away, clearing it afterwards. You hopefully have got your handout for this evening. Obviously it's slightly different, you'll see, if you were here last week, obviously because we had the whole introduction to Kings that Mark was doing last week, but there's a few bits that we're going to pick up on as we go through. I've included again the quote from Donald Wiseman, you'll see, just because I think it gave a really helpful kind of overview in the sense of why are we looking at Kings, what does it have to say to us today. All right, do we need some more? We've got you want to come. So you'll find that in there, and I've also included, again, just repeated the definition of Baal, because again, that feeds very much into the passage we're looking at this evening. So to have that handy, I thought would be useful. Just to say, in terms of the plan this evening, and we're going to try and stick to it as well this evening, is about kind of 8:15. We'll break. Up until that point, we're going to be working through and we're sharing on 1 Kings 17:7-24. We'll break for about 15 minutes or so. It's an opportunity to stretch your legs and get a cup of tea, cup of coffee. And then about 8:30, we'll come back and then have an opportunity kind of in tables and small groups just to explore some of the discussion questions. So we're not going to work through all of them, but it may be as kind of last week, actually, maybe one or two that really jump at you that we may talk about. And then what I'd like to do is kind of to conclude, that would be about for 15 minutes or so, 15, 20 minutes, then actually just conclude with an opportunity just to share with one another around our table so we can pray for one another before we head off. So that's kind of what we're aiming for this evening, but we'll see how we get on. Let's pray, and then we'll begin. Father God, we're going to come and look at your word, and that's such a joy, such a privilege to be able to delve into the truths that you've set before us. And as we gather this evening, whatever kind of day we've had, whatever it is that's rushing around our mind right now, whatever we're thinking about, whatever concerns we may have, whatever's going on tomorrow that maybe we're already beginning to prepare for, help us just to pause now. Help us to come and to meet with you afresh, to hear from you, and by your Spirit, may you impart to each of us and to us as a group gathered here your truths afresh for us this day. Amen. I want to pick up initially just kind of in the story so far. We're obviously going to be reading in a moment from 1 Kings 17:7 and following Elijah and the widow at Zarephath. If you haven't picked that up already, that's obviously on the front page. But obviously the preceding verses kind of really feed into this. Beginning of chapter 17, Elisha said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." And the drought was judgment on the nation's rampant idolatry. And we touched on this last week. If you were here, if you weren't, then I would encourage you to take the opportunity to listen back. But the rampant idolatry that was led by the royal couple, so Ahab and Jezebel. And in many ways, we see here this example that if Yahweh withholds rain, it proves that Baal is powerless, that their God is not actually God. He's a name and nothing more, and has no power whatsoever. What's more, as you read into this, the name Elijah actually means Yahweh is my God. And so in the days when Ahab's government are, officially supporting the worship of Baal, you've got this prophet whose very name is speaking the truth against it, and against him, and against what is being perpetrated and put around. And we find ourselves at a very crucial time for the people of God and for Israel. In many ways, it looked like the worship of God was actually going to be eliminated, potentially, in the northern kingdom, in the way things were developing. And there's kind of this sense, I came across this quote, that the land swarmed with the priests of Baal. So it wasn't that there was just one or two picking it around, but actually this is something that was spreading and was going to, you know, potentially take over. And so Elijah delivers this prophecy to Ahab, king of Judah, and then he's directed out of Ahab's territory. And so he hides, as we read, by the brook overlooking the Jordan called Kerith, from verse 3, you'll see. And we see that there God provides for Elijah. Something that is a recurring theme throughout this passage, and something that we're going to come back to this evening, that he's provided for by God and by God alone. Now, we could pause there and say, that's pretty great, you know, he's by this brook and God provides for him, and everything's great and he lived happily ever after. Obviously, as we read on, we see that that's not quite the case, but the opportunity for God again to come to the fore and be demonstrated in all his power is before Elijah now. So I'm going to read from verse 7 of 1 Kings 17. Sometime later, the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him. Go at once to Zarephath in the region of Sidon and stay there. I have directed a widow there to supply you with food. So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, would you bring me a little water in a jar so that I may have a drink? She was going to get it, he called, and bring me, please, a piece of bread. As surely as the Lord your God lives, she replied, I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little olive oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first, make a small loaf of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make yourself something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land. She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. Sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, what do you have to do against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son? Give me your son, Elijah replied. He took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, Lord, my God, have you brought tragedy even on this widow I am staying with by causing her son to die? Then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried out to the Lord, Lord, my God, let this boy's life return to him. The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, look, your son is alive. Then the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God, and the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth. It's difficult to accuse Elijah of playing it safe, or certainly having it easy as we read through here. Even in these 18 verses, there's something of that kind of roller coaster ride that he goes upon, and this turbulence that is before him. And actually, it's also remembering that what we see here is a snapshot of something that is taking place within a bigger picture in terms of the narrative of his dealings with Ahab, which actually finds itself within an even bigger picture, as we thought about last week, in terms of 1 Kings. Beginning at verse 7, sometime later, obviously, Elijah's by the brook, dries up because there'd been no rain. Sometime later, and it came to pass after a while, perhaps even up to a year potentially, he may have spent there. Some potentially link it to Exodus 13:10, where God is instructing Moses in terms of the consecration of the firstborn. And there's a similar phrase used in verse 10 of Exodus 13. It says, you must keep this ordinance at the appointed time year after year. And thus, we're talking about quite a time frame here. It wasn't just a couple of days or a week or so. And the heavy rains, of late autumn and early winter have failed to materialise. Can ask the question, wonder why? We'll read back to the start of the chapter. But the brook dries up, and the word of the Lord comes to him. And there's this clear guiding in verse 8, when it comes to him and tells him, go on, verse 9, to Zarephath. He's sent back into Baal territory, which again is quite important when you think about what he's going to do and what he's going to experience and how God's power is going to be demonstrated. Go at once to Zarephath in the region of Sidon. You'll find in the handout on the second page a map just trying to illustrate where he would have travelled from. So he's gone from the Kereth Brook all the way to Zarephath. This is back into Jezebel's homeland. It's controlled by Ahab's father-in-law. And it's probably about 7 miles south of Sidon that he actually heads to. And there's this sense of God kind of moving things into place. I had the image almost of kind of someone playing chess, if you will. And God's moving Elijah into position. Because obviously, not only is Baal incapable of overcoming the drought that God has brought upon the land, but the provision of Yahweh for Elijah is going to happen in the heart of Baal territory. Again, this nuance of actually what God is demonstrating. And it's almost that if Baal did exist, this is all happening right under his nose. No, obviously he doesn't, but it's almost that sense of this is what's being demonstrated. Similar, I think, to when we look later on at Mount Carmel, when you have the pouring on of the water, kind of numerous times. It's this sense of upping the stakes and really demonstrating the power of God. Really showing who actually is in charge, so to speak. And I'm sure Elijah would have been aware of where he was heading, both in terms of God initially taking him to the brook, Kereth Brook, but also back into Baal territory. Therefore, this was going to be a trial for the prophet's faith. Again, we see this up and down in terms of Elijah's walk and his journey, being sent back across the land. And he's sent to this widow. We're told that he's sent, we're not told her name. We're given hints about her status, as we'll see as we go through. But not a lot is given in terms of who she was and what she was all about. We do have this sense, though, that actually she had no idea that she was to care for Elijah. However much God says, I've directed the widow there to supply you with food, it's almost as if she failed to get that memo. And Elijah heads to her, but in the interaction that they have, it's not a case that, oh, I was expecting you. It's great you've arrived. So in verse 10 we see Elijah goes to Zarephath, and I say this is a fair distance that he travels. We're talking probably about 100 miles, give or take. That he travels. And I don't know whether you've ever been on any kind of long walks, and more than just kind of to the shops and back. But actually, if you do a day's walking or you go on a hiking holiday, by the end of each day, and certainly after you've kind of completed it, there's that sense within you that you're going to be weary, you're going to need sustenance. And it's that position that we find Elijah in here. As he's travelled, he would have been, as I say, tired from his journey and in need of water and in need of food. And so he sees this widow. And I wonder, it's not that she had a sign on her head necessarily or anything like that. But obviously God guides him, brings him to this place. He sees her and obviously recognises her, maybe potentially from her appearance, but also by what she's doing. As a widow, back then she would have been poor, quite likely. She would have been kind of not the center of attention, if you will, or the center of the community at all. She does have a home, as we find out later on. So she's not completely bankrupt or destitute. But as the narrative unfolds, she's definitely not in a great place. She's collecting sticks to be able to make a fire to cook her last meal so her son and her can eat and then die. And it's this kind of really rather grim situation that we read about here. And so Elijah sees her and calls her, asking for a drink. And initially, verse 11, she goes and goes to get him one. But obviously, as she's going, he calls to her and, "Bring me, please, a piece of bread." And my initial thought was, well, he's polite at least. He doesn't kind of demand it from her. He remembers his please and thank yous and that sort of thing. On the surface, though, it was okay to go and get him a drink. But actually, what he's asking here, it's kind of really pushing the button, if you will. Really actually asking something that almost you just can't contain. I don't know if you ever find yourselves in those situations where you're trying to keep a lid on things, people are saying things to you, and you just kind of can hold it and hold it and hold it, and then something happens, and it's, you know, that phrase, the straw that breaks the camel's back, is almost what's that tipping point. And for her, it's obviously this final request, and so this outburst follows. Verse 12, "As surely as the Lord your God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little olive in oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." It's not a great picture that we get here. Again, we see, though, to give her credit, that she's polite in her response to Elijah. However much, I imagine there would have been some emotion with it, and a sense of something that had really built. "As the Lord your God lives," she says, showing respect for Elijah's God, recognizing that the God of Israel was Elijah's God, not hers. But she's, you know, literally a handful of flour, a little olive oil, and she's going to make this meal so her and her son can go and die. And she appears to be at that point where she can literally, you know, only just offer the facts to Elijah, because maybe life has just become too much of a burden. And it's kind of ebbing to an end. She's in this place of despair and desperation. And almost, you know, "I can't do what you've asked. Don't you see where I'm at and what I'm going through?" And Elijah's response, verse 18, he said to her, "Don't be afraid." He says, you know, "Go home, ask what I've done for you, and then make some for your son and yourself." And we see here this quite severe test that is put before the widow. This sense of, you know, I mean, it would be easy for her to respond kind of, you know, the cheek of it. "You've suddenly showed up and you want me to feed you first? I've just explained that this is all I've got and that my son and I, we have no hope. And you're wanting me to give you something to eat? Are you not listening to the situation and the stakes?" And he offers this sense of, you know, "Do not be afraid." And I came across as a professor, Catherine Shivadeka, she made this comment of trying to almost just think through what may have been going through the widow's mind. And maybe sometimes it can feed in for us as we think about how we respond sometimes in those situations. She says, almost imagining the widow's thoughts, "It's easy for you to say," we might imagine her thinking, "you're not the one preparing to cook one last meal for yourself and your son before you die. You're not the one who has watched your carefully hoarded supply of flour and oil relentlessly dwindle day by day, week by week, as the sun bakes the seed in the hard, parched earth and the wadis run dry. You're not the one who has watched your beloved son slowly grow thinner and more listless. What business," she says, "has the man of God to ask her for bread, she who has so little? What business has he asking her for bread before she feeds herself and her son? There's not enough to go around. There's not enough even for her and her son. The language he uses is the language of scarcity, a handful of meal, a little oil, a couple of sticks. There is not enough, and death waits at the door." Reflecting on this passage, I think it's one of those stories that sometimes we can skim over, and the severity of what is actually being put across here can sometimes be missed, particularly because we know how the story goes. As often is the case when we read things in the Bible, because we have hindsight and we have the full picture, we can miss actually what is taking place here. Elijah says, though, "Mia, don't panic." As he goes on, verse 14, "For the jar and the jug will not run out. It's going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine. And it will continue to provide." So she went away and she did as Elijah told her to. And it's that question, I suppose, of, you know, I wonder still what she would have been thinking as she headed off to do that. Even though he'd said this, did she really believe it? Did she really actually think it was going to come to be? And again, as we think later, explore some of the questions, when we think about God speaking to us and saying things, do we sometimes, we hear this promise or we believe, you know, sense this is what God's saying, but actually, is he really going to come through? Is he really going to deliver? She goes away though, and the response, as we see, speaks for itself. Verse 16, for the jar of flour was not used up, the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. And there's some who would seek to argue, well, surely God should have just given her the lot. It was nice, the fact that he kind of provided for her, but wouldn't it have been better to actually just given her that massive upfront payment sort of thing? And then actually say, here it is, you know, you haven't got to worry for the next, you know, however long it is, just sit back, relax, I'm going to provide for you. It's interesting, there's various different thoughts. One, Spurgeon talks about this whole idea that actually, you know, imagine God had suddenly provided a mass of quantity for her. On a very practical level, that would have probably gone round the local community. And probably very quickly, there would have been those who would have thought, you know, there's a bit of a famine going on, there's a drought, life's not very great, but hey, she's got a massive supply, so we'll go and kind of nab it. And probably wouldn't have ended up very well for either the widow or her son. But also, I think there's a similarity that we can see here in terms of, I mean, Matthew 14, 19. Feeding of the 5,000, he directed the people, that's Jesus, to sit down on the grass, taking the 5 loaves, 2 fish, looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. You know, you kind of wonder, why didn't Jesus just click his fingers and suddenly everyone had in their hands, you know, their Big Mac and fries or whatever it was of the day? You know, why didn't he just suddenly, and without anything happening, it was there? In the same way here, it's that sense actually of the greater impact of actually God's provision. And imagine what it would have happened, that impact to her over time, as each time she went back and took out that flour, each time she went back and she poured from that jug and the oil kept flowing, each time reminding her of that encounter with Elijah and that moment when he appeared, and the fact maybe of how she initially responded to him, and so on and so forth. And so we see this widow, this godly non-Jewish woman, receiving this comfort in her moment of need. Deuteronomy 10:18-19 says, he defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt. And it's this demonstration of actually kind of no longer just this thin line of actually in and out and you're not like me, but actually really she's taking this on board and delivering it. But also we see that she begins, you know, she trusts Elijah. Her faith is rewarded. The word is confirmed, and it's that moment when the God of Israel is clearly seen as the giver in a land that supposedly is kind of, you know, overseen by a God who is, you know, kind of going to bring forth kind of growth and fertility, and actually isn't really coming up trumps at all, but yet the God of Israel is. And we see for Elijah in this moment, I think, you know, his strengthening his faith of God's provision again. We see as we read through further on, he has these real moments of doubt and question. And so it wasn't a case that he was always on cloud nine going, God is the best thing, he's always going to deliver and there's no worries at all. So I'm sure there would have been that moment actually, as this story, as say, unfolded, of that realization of who God is, what he's done, and the impact that he's having. So it's a reminder of God's provision for all who believe. And so then we have this moment between verse 16 and 17. And if you'll forgive me for a moment, this is where my mind went. This would be the perfect montage clip in a movie. Because you've just had this moment and it's all looking so great. So you'd have some feel-good music in the background. Something that just everyone just engages with. There'd be some shots of the widow smiling. Because that, you know, would be great. There'll be some shots of Elijah playing with the boy. Again, it's just this happiness. There'd be laughter. because there always seems to be in those kind of montage clips, you never know what they're laughing about, but it's obviously something that's causing them joy. And I imagine there would have been a sunset as the end of a day that's just been wonderful, and it's just glorious. We read in verse 17, sometime later, after these things, the widow and the son, they've been rescued from death by famine, but sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. Suddenly that montage is just been obliterated because the boy dies. And some would say, oh, well, he was just holding his breath, wasn't he? Little scamp. He was just messing around, and actually it wasn't really anything much going on. She was just overreacting. She was doing that thing that parents do. You're in our house, if you happen to be kind of sick, physically, then Emma would help you and support you, because I don't deal well with those unless I really have to. For me though, I respond if there's blood and if someone cuts themselves or something like that sort of thing. Although I do have a tendency sometimes to kind of almost jump in as if like it's the end of the world. Because it might be. The other year, Ella was in one of our garden chairs, one of the ones that you can lean back on, but it folds up if you lean back too far. And she leaned right back over, went straight over. And I'm run over, and I'm on the barbecue, and I've left it, and I'm just like, oh no, what's happened? And she's laughing, and it's fine. And maybe that's what's going on here, some would suggest. But really, the mother just needs to deal with herself. Because it's not really that bad. Now, the child is dead. Seen through, you look at the response of the mother, you look through the physical actions that take place. This isn't some kind of, you know, thing that's been misunderstood. Verse 19, Elijah, you know, he says, give me your son. Elijah replied, he took him from her arms. You know, she was obviously cradling him. We're not told exactly how old he was, but there was obviously this sense of kind of holding him in that moment of despair, of just complete, you know, what's happening. And just as kind of an aside, I think it's important to recognise that as you read through this passage, and as you read through passages in 2 Kings, you might think, this is very similar to something else, someone else. Obviously, Elisha goes through similar sort of events. There's a widow, and she is provided oil, and there's this miracle. It's different, but it's similar to what we read here. There's the son who in the passage as well, who actually this woman gives birth to as kind of an initial miracle, but yet again he dies, and there's a famine around that time. And so some might say, well, surely actually what we're getting here, actually, because the passage with Elisha is more detailed, some would suggest, well, this is just a copy, really. They just filled space. Kind of text or whatever. But yet if you actually see the details are different. And I think again the argument that, well, it's the same miracle just being repeated, you know, kind of put in text twice when it actually only happened once, I think it is rubbish. You look throughout the Bible, you look at the accounts of Jesus, you know, the number of blind people that we're told that he healed, the number of hungry that he fed. And I don't think every waking moment of Elisha or Elijah is detailed here. We don't get every single footstep, every breath put down on the page. And actually, by making that link between the two, I think it not only illustrates the connection that they have, but also the God they serve. And the power of that God, the God, worked through them. So in many ways, I think that link actually is more of an authentication than a question. Returning to the passage though, the child is dead. She turns on Elijah actually, and says kind of, you know, verse 18, what have you done? What have you brought about? You know, what did you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son? And it's interesting, there's this sense, obviously, she blames Elijah, you know, what have you done, man of God, you know, the prophet, you know, doubting, even though he's, you know, kind of massively impacted her life positively, you know, the fact that, well, did he come to meddle and cause problems and grief, but also blames herself, And there's that guilt memory of something. We're not told what it is, but there's obviously something that she seeming to allude to that she thinks, well, maybe, you know, she did that. And is it why you're bringing it back up? That's what this has come about. Elijah, though, takes the child, verse 19, took him in his arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. The upper room, it would have been the norm to have kind of structures on the roof, temporary tents, if you will, common practice. Occurs to me, it's great thought for my in-laws come this Christmas. We'll get the tent up in the garden for them. I'm sure they'll be happy if it's the done thing. But it also would have allowed her privacy and her reputation to be upheld. So that's where he probably was, would have been staying. And so he took the boy up. And verse 20, it says, and he cried out to the Lord, Lord my God, have you brought tragedy on this widow I am staying with by causing her son to die? Almost a sense of what have you done? What's going on here? Sensing there's something more than just an illness or a practical everyday incident. And then we see in verse 21 this really bizarre, in many ways, prayer technique. It's also quite unusual because it's actually a violation of Numbers 9, 6 and 7, where it talks about how you mustn't come into contact with dead bodies. And there's no real precedent to what Elijah does here. Some would say, well, it's because of the thrice God. The Lord, number six, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. And the Lord turn his face towards you. And it's the sense of that's where he's got the number three from. So he's having a good go to link there. Some would suggest that this is kind of picking up on the Babylonian practice of contactual magic, which is a load of rubbish. Some would say it's the first example of mouth-to-mouth. Which again, I think as you look at it, if you think that, you're missing the point of what is going on here. And actually, I think there's a helpful lesson as well for us, is that actually the technique is not what's important here. It's because of God and the faith in God and the power of God that this boy is brought back to life. And I wonder whether sometimes we can get caught up in the part that we play, and almost if we don't get it right, well, it may not happen. And actually, by my being involved, we think of prayer ministry, if I'm praying for someone's shoulder, the fact that I put my hand on their shoulder, is that going to mean God's going to heal them any more or any less? No, it's not. And sometimes I think it can lead, we almost get caught up in these things of reading stuff into both the text, but also coming up with these kind of practices that we think will result in a certain outcome. It's interesting too about reading into the text. There's some who actually take this passage particularly and actually believe they read into it the fact that the child grows up to be Jonah, which A, just doesn't fit timeline. There's a whole load of problems in it. But I think it illustrates sometimes how we can take things and actually develop them in a certain way that is just not helpful and is actually wrong. What's clear here is God moves. God moves and life is restored into this boy. The Lord heard Elijah's cry, verse 22, and the boy's life returned to him and he lived. And we see the second stage of God's miraculous provision here. As God again, not Baal, is the giver of life. And there's no kind of doubt in terms of who's at work here. Who is actually, power is being outworked. And we actually have the first kind of example in the Bible here of revival from death as well. And it's key that we remember that God alone has that power. And so then in verse 23 we read, Elijah picked up the child, carried him down from the room into the house, gave him to his mother and said, look, your son is alive. And potentially reference back in Hebrews 11:35, where it says women receive back their dead, raised to life again. There's that possible link there. But then verse 24, the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you're a man of God and the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth. And we see in this passage a reminder that God often uses unlikely people and sources to accomplish his purposes. We have this reminder here that actually the people that we would naturally choose, the people that we would naturally go to, those that we would think be at the front of the list, maybe not ourselves or someone else, actually God doesn't work like that. God uses often uses unlikely people and sources. But also the fact that God's mercy extends to all people. We're reminded of that here. Both Jews and Gentiles. You know, this woman was blessed for her faith. And then thirdly, also reminded that God requires faith. In many ways, the widow, you know, kind of responded. She could have initially said to Elijah, you know, you're just off your rocker. Get out of here. Who are you? But no, she responded. She stepped out. And it's saying, how will we actually be people who respond to God in faith? Responding to the things that he says to us. Responding to the opportunity to know him, to love him, and to walk through life with him. So we're going to take a break shortly. Going to give a moment just if people have anything they want to come back to straight away. And then we'll take a break for about 15 minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll explore both some of the questions that are in the back page, but also if there's other comments or questions that people want to come out of this directly. Before we pause, is there anything anyone wants to come back with straight away? So, can you just repeat the first bit again? In that you, what you... I suppose that's where I think, as a church body, that's in part, but also in terms of from the leadership as well, in actually that not instantly kind of responding. I think it's checking out, does it match with the Word of God? Is it something that maybe there's other things that feed into it and back it up? But also not kind of instantly just kind of going, well, we'll go with the latest thing, and the latest craze or latest fad. Francis.
I always found the answer if someone says, you know, God says so and so, I find two or three other Christian people who I trust and ask them to wear it with me to confirm it. Say no, it's not of God, and you know, that sort of takes the pressure off, if you like. Let God decide.
Well, we'll take a break till about 25 past. We're about 5 minutes ahead, so we're about 25 past. We'll come back in here, grab a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, or cold drink, or none at all. And then we'll gather back together and explore some of the kind of potential next steps and implications. Okay.